Welcome to the first State of the State, and thanks for listening. Each month, we'll aim for a lively discussion of Michigan policy and current events, and we'll run down three or four hot topics, pointing to some research on each policy issue. Today, we'll cover income tax cuts, Detroit's bid for Amazon's second headquarters, and the proposal for a part-time legislature. Here, we'll aim to provide historical and national context. We won't be your best source for day-to-day legislative politics, who's winning and losing, and political strategy advice, but we can provide a researcher's view of how policy differs across states, how Michigan is positioned nationally, and the influence of policy on economic and social outcomes. We'll usually have a guest, but today I'm joined by my co-host and economist, Dr. Charlie Ballard. Let's get started with the proposed income tax cuts, where we have some new data on what the Michigan public thinks.
Thanks, Matt. The Michigan income tax is currently at a flat rate of 4.25%. That's on all taxable income. That makes Michigan unusual because most states have a graduated tax where there are higher rates on high-income folks. There have been proposals for many years to roll back the rate from 4.25 to some lower number, typically 3.9. And there was an attempt in the Michigan legislature in March, which came very close to passing, but it did not pass. But in our most recent round of the State of the State survey, our public opinion survey of Michigan adults, we asked a sample of about 1,000 Michigan adults, what do you think about rolling back from 4.25 to 3.9? And we found some very interesting results. If you just ask people, what do you think about a tax cut? They like it. 68% said that they were in favor of the tax cut. But we also asked the question in a different way for different groups of our respondents. In one case, we said, what do you think about the tax cut? But remember that that would reduce revenues in 2018 by about $1 billion. Well, when we got people to think about the fact that there would be a revenue effect and that that might mean lower spending on roads or schools or whatever, then the favorability dropped from 68% to 52%. But then for the other group, we asked, what do you think about this income tax cut? And we noted that millionaires get a whole lot more back than the average household. And then the favorability dropped to 38%. So it really makes a big difference how you ask the question. If you just say, you want a tax cut, people say sure. But then if you give a little bit of additional information, there are still supporters, but it's not nearly as strong a support.
And people tend not to see the trade-offs in public policy. It's a pretty general phenomenon. People want low taxes, higher spending on everything the government spends money on, and balanced budgets. So if you can square that circle, then the public will be happy.
Yeah. If you can cut taxes and raise spending and still balance your budget, that would be really neat. But I'm not sure that I think that's going to happen anytime soon.
Now, we should say that passage of this proposed income tax cut is not very likely in the near term. But, of course, it's a pretty fundamental part of the Republican platform to get lower taxes. So I wouldn't be surprised if it comes back up. One reason that it came up now is we're sort of in a better short-term budget situation than a long-term budget situation. We have promised a whole bunch of business tax credits, primarily to the auto industry, but they haven't cashed most of them in yet, so could get a worse budget situation later. And then the second thing is that we cut business property taxes, and we promised local governments that we'd fill in some of their revenue. So it looks like we have more money than we actually do right now, and in the next few years, we could start paying the bills.
I think there's always a danger that, the latest revenue forecast says, oh, we've got a few hundred million than we thought we had, more than we thought we had, and then people say, oh, that's great. But that ignores the long-run context, which is that over the last 40 or 45 years, we have dramatically reduced the extent to which we tax ourselves. And you can see the results of that every day when you drive on roads. I have the misfortune to drive on some roads in my home township every day that I tell you, only chiropractors and auto body shops could like those roads. And that's the result of the fact that we've reduced revenue and reduced revenue and reduced it again. Part of it is that many of the taxes that we have don't keep up with the economy. Maybe the best known example of that is that the sales tax is only on things that you buy in the hardware store and the department store. It's not on services and entertainments, which have grown so much more rapidly. And the income tax doesn't apply to a whole lot of pension income. And so there are lots of ways in which the tax system doesn't keep up.
And we have a flat tax that's built into the Constitution, where even though most people favor a higher percentage tax on higher income, we have a flat tax, and that tends to make it easier to cut taxes and harder to raise taxes, because you can't say somebody over there will pay, not you. And we also have a lot of strictures on local governments, so that they really can't raise sales taxes. And so one of the few things that they can do is establish a 1% income tax. So we have 22 cities that have done that, and a couple more that are thinking about it. So how do we compare to other states, and kind of where we get our revenue from?
We're not a very unusual state in a lot of ways. Most states, if you look at the state and local revenues, it's property taxes, sales taxes, and income taxes are the big three, and we have all of those. We're a little bit more heavily reliant on property taxes than the average state, and that's even after the property tax cuts that we've had in a variety of times, especially in 1994. But we're not a terribly odd state. All states, really across the country, have reduced the extent to which they raise revenue from their own sources, and that has put many, many state and local governments, not just in Michigan, in a revenue bind.
Well, one of the things that that tax revenue might allow is to make our cities attractive to new business and new jobs. And we did see a big recent effort in the Detroit area to try to bring Amazon's big second headquarters to the area. Of course, we're competing with 230 other places there, so I don't think we can cash any checks late already. But we are in the running. A few people have mentioned us as potential finalists, so we'll see how far we make it. But it did bring together quite a few partners. Of course, we haven't seen all the details. They weren't released, so there are going to be multiple sites that are potential, but we don't yet know where they are. But we do know that it was somewhat international and somewhat regional. So what do you think our prospects are, and what's the major ups and downsides to Amazon moving to Detroit?
Well, I think the biggest upside is that Detroit, unlike a lot of our competitors, because of the decline that Detroit has experienced over the last 60 years, there is vacant land. Land is available in Detroit in various parts of the city, much more cheaply than you would find it in a lot of other places. So that's a big plus. Also, I think from a public relations standpoint, Detroit has, after a very tough time, has finally bottomed out. There are parts of Detroit, downtown, midtown, the Woodward Corridor, that are actually vibrant now and are growing, and other parts that are hanging on. Amazon could position itself as a part of that comeback story, and I think that would be a really good one.
We might be the best from a public relations perspective, at least.
I think so. Yeah, I'd love to write the ads about we're part of Detroit's resurgence. On the downside, it's still true that the city of Detroit has a lot of problems, a lot of poverty. The city finally emerged from its bankruptcy, and it frankly emerged in better shape from the bankruptcy than I had feared. Judge Rhodes was able to get together a package that allowed the city to get past some of its immediate funding problems. But it's still, there are problems with Detroit, and one of them is that it has a sort of a black eye reputationally. You know, most people think of Detroit, they think of abandoned buildings and so on. But, you know, I think that Detroit is a viable candidate. I hope that it's given very, very serious consideration by the folks at Amazon.
And what about talent? That's usually seen as a potential downside to Detroit's bid, but I hear you don't necessarily think so.
I think that's a phony argument. There is no place in America, none of the couple hundred cities that are in the running for this, none of them has 50,000 engineers just sitting around unemployed waiting for a call from Amazon. No matter where you go, you're going to have to get people from someplace else. And frankly, we have more talent than we're sometimes given credit for. We do have, after all, great engineering programs at University of Michigan, at Michigan State, at Wayne State. We've got a lot of talented people who could be drawn in to this with Amazon. So I think it's that argument is overblown. Wherever Amazon locates, they're going to have to get people from someplace else to come to that location. And then the question is, will people come from Boston or Austin or California or New York or wherever to Detroit? Well, please. If I'm an engineer and Amazon calls me up and says, here, good salary, we got a job for you in Detroit, I'm gonna go. I'm going to take that very seriously. I don't think people are going to just say, I've heard some bad things about Detroit, so I'm not going to go. After all, the people who they want to attract would not have to live right next to the facility. They could live in Livonia, they could live in Ferndale, they could live in lots of places if they don't want to live in Detroit. And frankly, Detroit is a more attractive place than it used to be because of some of the improvements that we've seen in recent years.
And one of the things that usually happens when you have 230 bidders is that the price goes up fast. And the research on business development incentives is pretty bleak overall. It seems to show that cities and states provide a lot of tax incentives and other kinds of subsidization, and that there's sort of a winner's curse. That is, if you if you're the one to win the factory or to win the new business, then you're also the one who maybe bid too high. And so we don't see as much as people think that you are going to provide the incentives to business and you'll see the benefits in jobs and economic growth. There really just isn't the evidence to support those policies.
No, the evidence is at best, it's very mixed, and it's not very satisfactory. We in Michigan in particular, I think we've had a tendency that anytime a business shows up and says, give us tax credits, we'll create jobs, we say, okay, here's money. And then there hasn't been much accountability. And to the extent that there has been accountability, it's not clear that we've gotten the bang for the buck. I would love for all the governors to get together and sign a non-aggression pact where they just say, look, we're not going to do this anymore, because what they do is there's a race to the bottom. There's always a race to the bottom, and the all of the surplus is extracted by the company that gets people to bid for their services. And it's great for the company, great for their shareholders. Not so good for the states and localities that are in the bidding.
And we've had a funny kind of political cycle where each governor comes in and kind of says they're going to get rid of the business development incentives that the last governor had in place. But Snyder's repeating the cycle where you get rid of some of those business development incentives, but then by the end of your term, you start to bring your own incentives back in and kind of repeat the pattern.
Well, it's very difficult because the political imperative is to appear to be trying as hard as you possibly can try. And what people have come to expect is that trying hard means offering these incentives. But as we say, I just don't think it's been very effective. And so I'm doubtful that if we get Amazon, that we'll get as good a deal as we might have. And I just hope that we don't give away the store. I still want them to come.
And is there any bright side to the bidding process? Detroit area historically hasn't been great for regional cooperation or international cooperation, but are there signs that might be changing?
There is that upside, and that's not just in Detroit. It's all across the country in these communities that have been forced to think hard about what would we have to do to get Amazon to come. And they may put together some attractive packages, and they may think hard about it. And if we could get more regional cooperation in Detroit Metro, that would be a great thing for the state of Michigan, because we have, in terms of transportation and various other things, we have been sorely lacking in terms of regionalism.
Well, historically, Michigan has had a lot of government resources at the state level to consider policy changes like this. There is a proposal on the horizon by the lieutenant governor to try to change our legislature to be part-time. And it's being sold as sort of a small government venture. What do you make of that?
I make not much of that. If you were to add up all the money that we'd save by cutting legislatures' salaries in half, it would be just a drop in the bucket of the state budget. It really doesn't do much in terms of saving money. And in fact, I fear that it would be counterproductive, because we already have a very non-professional legislature because of the term limits. We have people who just don't have a whole lot of experience and knowledge base. This would make our legislature even less professional. Our legislators would be even less knowledgeable in all likelihood. And that would cede more power, I think, to lobbyists. And the lobbyists are not going to be less professional. The legislature can disarm, but the lobbyists will not. So I'm not all that enthusiastic about this. I also worry about... right now, there are people who consider being a member of the legislature to be their job. It's their employment. If it were a half-time job, there are a lot of talented people who, for personal and financial reasons, would say, gee, I just can't go for that. And I fear that we would not draw from as wide a pool of potential legislators as we might. I think people who are independently wealthy would be disproportionately likely to end up in the legislature, and I'm not sure whether that would be a representative legislature.
Yeah, the research on this is a little bit difficult because there are a lot of things associated with whether a state becomes professionalized in the first place in its legislature. But there is a reason, I think, that conservatives are more supportive of this idea, which is that states that meet less often tend to have smaller governments. They tend to pass fewer bills, as we might expect. That's usually not something that liberals are as excited about as conservatives. I wouldn't say that we know that it's actually the part-time legislature that's causing those differences. In fact, what we usually see is that the full-time legislatures don't meet quite as often as we think that they might, and then the part-time legislatures meet a little more often than it says they should in the
statutes. There are other ways to get together besides right in the session.
Yeah, and the surveys of state legislative offices across states show that most of these part-time legislatures are working close to full-time. They are working less, but they tend to fill up the time nonetheless. There's not a whole lot of evidence of differences in terms of who runs for office. We suspect that it might be more attractive to earn a higher salary and so forth, and that might be attractive to different kinds of occupations. But the same types of people tend to run for office across the states, sort of regardless of the institutions that are there.
Yeah.
So The main way that this is being sold, at least in the petitions, is that it would cut the legislators' pay.
Right.
But, of course, most of the cost of the legislature is in the staffing rather than the legislators. So is that enough of a sort of successful political argument to just say, cut their pay, we don't like them? And do you think people want less staff as well? Or might they be more concerned if some of the institutional support for the legislators would go down?
Well, this is another case where I think the slogan, cut the bums' pay, the slogan sells well. Just like at the beginning of our podcast, we were talking about if you just say you want a tax cut, people say sure. But then when people are given additional information, I think they might find it to be less appealing than it first appeared to be. And so I hope that's what happens in this case, that once the public gets a little bit more sense of what's involved, that we would not rush into going to a part-time legislature, because it's not at all clear to me that that would make for a better Michigan.
So how would you tie together these three issues that we've talked about today? What have we learned?
Well, I think we've learned that it's necessary to make investments. If we want Michigan to be the kind of vibrant and healthy place that I think it can be and I want it to be, it's going to cost money. And some of that money can come through the private sector, but there are certain things that the public sector really needs to do in terms of investments in transportation infrastructure and in education. And a common theme throughout our conversation today has had to do with budgets and taxes. And I think we've gone awfully far in Michigan toward tax cuts, not always with good results. What do you take away?
Well, I think people should remember that institutional changes have long-term effects, and when we make a change, we're usually thinking about the short term, but the long term can have a big effect. So we wrote in a flat income tax into the Constitution, and we're still dealing with the consequences today. We kind of constrained the way that local governments could raise revenues, and that's affecting how governments are going to support potential businesses coming. And, of course, we're considering what would be a huge change in the legislature to make it part-time. And although we don't have a whole lot of evidence that it's going to make an immediate impact on, say, the size and scope of government, the long-term effects are likely to be pretty big.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
So thanks for joining us. A reminder that we have lots more information on our Michigan Policy Wonk blog, including some posts from Charlie and I. And we also have our research database, which covers some of the studies that we've mentioned today. And you can find all of that at ippsr.msu.edu. We also have some live policy events in downtown Lansing, so hopefully you'll either be able to join us in person or next month when we have another edition of State of the State.